Hello, and welcome back to Texas Tech Health Check from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center. I'm your host, Melissa Whitfield. We want you to get healthy and stay healthy with help from evidence-based advice from our physicians, healthcare providers, and researchers. Last week, we celebrated Halloween, and many of us also celebrated Dia de los Muertos and All Saints Day and All Souls Day, the time of year when we remember loved ones who have passed away. These holidays also give us an opportunity to think about grief. However, some people, regardless of age, might be having a harder time than others. Prolonged grief disorder is when the feelings of intense grief persists and prevents someone from continuing on with their life. Our guest for this episode is Dr. Natalie Scanlon, clinical psychologist in the Department of Psychiatry. Dr. Scanlon explains what prolonged grief disorder is, how they diagnose it and treat it, and gives us advice on what we can do for our family, friends, or coworkers who are grieving. Dr. Scanlon, welcome back.
Thank you for having me again.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do here at the Health Sciences Center and your expertise?
Yeah, so I am a clinical psychologist by trade, and I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry in the School of Medicine here at TTUHSC.
Well, again, welcome back.
Thank you.
And you're here for this episode to talk to us about prolonged grief disorder. Can you tell us what it is, how it's diagnosed, and what are the symptoms?
Sure. This is an important conversation because prolonged grief disorder, or PGD, is actually a newer diagnosis in the DSM. So the DSM is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. It's the Bible when it comes to psychiatry and psychology. And there's actually been some controversy around prolonged grief disorder. So some people believe that by including it in the DSM as a diagnosis, it can be billed by insurance companies. People can receive treatment for grief, which can often be very helpful. Other people feel like including it in the DSM is pathologizing a very normal process, which grief is. And so quite a bit of controversy, but as a diagnosis, it falls under the trauma and stressor-related disorders. And it's diagnosed when somebody experiences the death of a loved one at least 12 months ago. So it's really not diagnosed unless you're a child or a teen, which we'll talk about in a bit, really not diagnosed until a year or more after somebody has passed away. And what we see with PGD is the presence of really a persistent grief response. So that could include intense longing for the person who died and or preoccupation with thoughts or memories of the person who died. It's diagnosed when people have additionally at least three of the following symptoms. So identity disruption, feeling like you kind of lose yourself with the loss of the person. Disbelief about their death, so feeling almost like you're constantly in that denial stage of grief where you wake up and don't think that it's real. Avoidance of reminders that the person has died. Intense emotional pain. Difficulty getting back into life following loss. So we'll talk a little bit about functional impairment and not being able to really function after the death. And then emotional numbness or feeling that life is now meaningless, as well as intense loneliness. Those can all be symptoms of PGD, and we look for at least three of those in addition to really that persistent grief response.
How is it different from depression or just feeling a loss over someone who died?
This is a great question. So depression may have a specific trigger when we diagnose major depressive disorder or persistent depressive disorder, which are two additional disorders in that DSM. For some people, depression diagnoses do have a specific trigger, such as the loss of a person, but depressive symptoms tend to be more widespread and not specifically related to grief or loss. Now, what's interesting about that is there used to be a grief qualifier for a diagnosis of depression in an older version of the DSM. So it used to be the case that if somebody came into the office and they met all the criteria for a depression diagnosis, but they experienced the loss of a loved one within the past 2 months, we couldn't diagnose depression because we assumed those symptoms were due to grief and loss. That qualifier was taken out, and then the prolonged grief disorder was added into the DSM as a completely separate diagnosis. And it actually falls in a completely separate camp of the DSM. We've got the depressive disorders as a camp, and then we've got the trauma and stressor-related disorders, which is where PGD falls under. What I'll also say about this is that we also can consider the typical stages of grief, right? Most people have heard about anger, denial, bargaining, depression, acceptance. There's a sixth one now, which is called finding meaning. And those are really typical. There's no normal way to do grief, but that's often what we see when people walk through a grief process. When it comes to prolonged grief disorder, we find that that presentation is obviously prolonged, which is in the name, and causes functional impairment. So somebody is grieving and they're not able to live their life. They're not able to get back to even activities of daily functioning. And so it becomes diagnostic in that sense.
So what can you tell us about young children or teenagers with PGD?
Yeah, another great question. So the latest version or edition of the DSM estimates that PGD may affect about 18% of youth in the United States. So a really sizable number of kids and teens who are going through a prolonged grief episode. And kids and teens can receive a diagnosis of prolonged grief disorder, again, if they have experienced the death of a loved one at least 6 months prior. So for adults, it's a year. For kids and teens, it's 6 months. For young kids, I'll kind of break this down into young kids versus teens. For young kids, we tend to see symptoms come out in play. So all of those symptoms that I mentioned at the beginning are not necessarily things you're going to just see every day with kids or that they'll talk about, but you may see some of those things come out in their play or in their reenactment of things. Oftentimes, young kids do not understand the permanence of death, and so you may hear them talk about the loved one is asleep or will come back at some point. For young kids, we see more anger and acting out, as well as physical symptoms. So they might talk about having tummy aches or headaches, as opposed to being able to say, I'm really sad or I'm really nervous. We can see developmental regression. So, you know, really young kids may have regression with potty training or speech or academic milestones after the death of a loved one. I think we especially see that when there's the death of a caregiver or a parent, which is a huge disruption in the development and the world of a child. And then separation anxiety is really quite common when a young child experiences the death of a loved one. So they tend to latch on to the loved ones who remain and are really nervous about being outside of their care. A couple of other symptoms we see with youth. One is preoccupation on the circumstances of the death itself, whereas with adults, the preoccupation is on the thoughts and the memories of the person who died. We tend to see kids and teens ask lots of questions kind of over and over about how they died, and adults can feel really uncomfortable in those situations because they don't know how specific they should be. We don't want to lie to kids, but at the same time, we don't want to be triggering or traumatizing to them, so that creates a lot of questions. Caregivers are oftentimes the ones, you know, who are in charge of planning memorial services and other things. Sometimes kids and teens would rather avoid memorial services or going to the graveside or celebrating the loved one's birthday. So we tend to see efforts to avoid any loss reminders when it comes to youth. And then when it comes to teens, I think two things stand out. One is they often report emotional numbness. So maybe saying like, I don't feel anything in response to this. I just feel nothing. And then the other one is an identity disruption because developmentally what teenagers are doing is developing their own sense of self. So when they lose somebody in their life who's really prominent and important, that identity development can kind of go off track and they can feel like they don't know who they are anymore. So really important things to look out for.
What are the treatments?
There are a couple that stand out to me that I use in my practice. So in general, cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, is a helpful treatment that really examines the interplay of thoughts, feelings, and behaviors when it comes to any number of disorders. And so I think CBT can be helpful in the context of grief. There's a more specific treatment called trauma and grief component therapy, which, if you think about the name, actually targets both trauma, PTSD, as well as grief. So that's a treatment that can be particularly helpful for kids and teens who have witnessed the death of a loved one in a very traumatic way and are grieving them in the aftermath of that. And then the final one is, and this is another evidence-based treatment, it's interpersonal therapy for adolescents. So interpersonal therapy for depression really looks at the roles that we and other people have in life. And so when you lose somebody, we really process, what role did you have in that person's life? What role did they have in your life? And not how do we move on, but how do we move forward in a way where you can still feel like you have meaningful roles?
So I know you mentioned the one-year timeline for adults. When should someone seek professional help? And what would you tell someone who might self-medicate instead to deal with their feelings?
Yeah, that latter one comes up a lot. So to address the first question, I would say whenever we encourage people to seek professional help, we really look for that functional impairment or what we call clinically significant distress or impairment in social, occupational, or other areas of functioning, right? So for adults after about a year or for kids after about 6 months, they're not able to go back to school or work. They're not able to be social. They're not able to leave the house. That's where we start to have some red flags pop up that professional help is indicated. I would also say, you know, when it comes to how long and how severely somebody grieves, there's no right or wrong answer for that because, again, there's no normal or typical way of grieving. But there are things that we can expect socially or culturally or religiously that can set some benchmarks for us. So if somebody's grief process is much longer than what's occurring in their culture or much more severe than what's occurring in their culture, we could talk about that and assist with some professional help. The final thing, you know, with regard to self-medicating, which we do see a lot when it comes to any number of mental health concerns, but certainly grief and trauma, I typically say self-medication may certainly have short-term gains, but long-term pains, and it's going to just prolong the grief process that needs to happen. We have to move through grief in order to get to the other side of it. There's no sidestepping it. There's no going around it. It's quite painful, but we do have to move through it to get to the other side. So I like to validate people when they self-medicate through alcohol, drugs, shopping, sex, any number of things. The dopamine hits feel really good in the moment, especially when you're going through a lot of pain. But you're providing a bandage for a bullet wound, and it's temporary. And so really would encourage people to get the help that they need to move through that grief, as painful as it might be.
How can we support our friends, family, or even coworkers who have PGD?
Yes, this is an important question, whether somebody has PGD or I think people feel quite lost in general when it comes to supporting loved ones who have lost a loved one. So the first thing I would say, just for all of our listeners, is to know that it's especially common to develop PGD for parents who lose a child, as well as for older adults who lose a loved one. So clinically, those are the two populations of people we tend to see where we're really on high alert if their grief will become PGD. That makes sense, right? It's devastating for a parent to lose a child. I heard somebody once say that's just not the natural order of things. Parents should pass before their children do. So those are really important subpopulations to be supportive of and to look out for. But then in general, I would say, don't try to make people in grief feel better or expect that they'll pick themselves up, right? there can be this tendency, because we are uncomfortable with difficult emotions, to kind of be like, are you okay? You're okay, right? Just be okay for me. And the person may not be okay, and that's okay, right? So get comfortable with uncomfortable emotions in order to really sit with people and to witness their grief, which is such an important part of the grief process. Grief is supposed to be witnessed. We used to live in much more collectivistic societies than we do now, or much more individualistic, but we need to witness each other's grief in order to move through it. So get comfortable with uncomfortable emotions. And then I think the final thing, and I hope for our listeners that this is an important, tangible takeaway, is to support people with loss reminders. Like, to recognize when it's the loved one's birthday or passing date, and reach out to the person you love and to say, I recognize that this is a hard day. What support can I offer you today? And specifically within that, there is something in the grief community called UAPS, which stands for Unwitnessed Absences of Parental Support. So this is specifically for kids who lose a parent. A lot of people think about the day that the parent died, or the birthday of the parent. But what they don't think about is when the child becomes able to drive or able to vote or gets married. Those are celebratory days, but those are painful days where the absence of their parent is really felt. And so recognize that and call it out. And a lot of people don't want to call it out because they don't want to be the one who brings the mood down. But the person experiencing the grief is already feeling that. And so if you call it out, you're witnessing their grief, which is so, so important.
Is there anything else you would like to add?
Really just two things. So there are those stages of grief that we have already talked about. There are now six stages. There used to be five when Elizabeth Kubler-Ross came out with the stages of grief and loss. So there are stages of grief, but I want people to understand there really is no normal way to grieve. There's no wrong way to grieve, except not to do it. That's the only wrong way, is if you try to avoid it, it's going to come back around like a boomerang. The other thing is, I follow the work of David Kessler, who was a student of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, and he quotes two things that I think are really important when it comes to grief. So one is, the goal is to remember with more love than pain, no matter what your relationship with the deceased person is or was, to remember with more love than pain. And then his definition of grief is that it's love in the absence of somebody. So loving them even though they're gone, and loving them in their absence. And I think reframing it that way can just be really helpful, because it's such a painful process.
Well, thank you so much for coming on our podcast and definitely giving us all this great information to think about, especially when we're around people who have lost someone.
Absolutely. And super important this time of year with holidays and loss reminders coming up. I think it's an important topic.
Yes, absolutely. Well, thank you.
Yeah, of course.
Thanks for listening to Texas Tech Health Check. Make sure to subscribe or follow wherever you listen to podcasts. This information is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice. Always seek immediate medical advice from your physician or your healthcare provider for questions regarding your health or medical condition. Texas Tech Health Check is brought to you by Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center and produced by Tierra Castillo, Susanna Cisneros, Mark Hendricks, Kay Williams, Tyler White, and me, Melissa Whitfield.